I'm here with Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of the Duran. Alexander, let's talk about phase one. Looks like is complete with the U.S.-China trade deal. And it looks like that China is starting to ease some tariffs, I believe, on around 800, 871 goods as well, even though the Chinese government says it's not related to what appears to be a completion of the phase one trade talks between the U.S. and China. There is some overlap there. So take us into what's going on with the U.S.-China trade talks and the recent decision by the Chinese government to ease up on some of the tariffs that they've imposed.
I think the first thing to say is that when the Chinese government says that there isn't, you know, that these two things are unrelated, the tariff reductions and the progress of the trade negotiations, you need to take that with a very big pinch of salt. If the trade negotiations had not been making progress, or at least what Beijing sees as progress, we would not be seeing these tariff reductions, and we would not be seeing the Chinese ramping up purchases of US agricultural goods, as we have been seeing. Now, what has happened? I think that 2019 was the year when the trade war really began to take off. We saw the United States and China struggling to come to any kind of trade deal with each other. We saw the United States, the Trump administration, imposing tariffs across the, you know, across the board against Chinese goods, and we saw the Chinese in turn retaliating by imposing their own tariffs against the United States. I think what has happened is that as the year has ended, both sides, both the US and China, have taken a step back and have looked at the situation, and I think they both are of the view that this economic divorce, which I have talked about, is what is going to happen, but that it has been rushing ahead too fast. So for Donald Trump's point of view, his priority now is to win the 2020 election. He does not want a massive tariff war with the Chinese, which is going to affect US agricultural exports and is going to hurt badly voters in the Midwest, whom he needs in order to win the election. So he has an incentive to see a deal done. China, for its part, not only needs time to start to recalibrate away from trade with the US, but it is also, and this has been not very widely reported, facing something of an agricultural crisis at the moment, in that there's a large proportion of the Chinese pig population. Pork is an enormously important part of the Chinese diet. A large part of the Chinese pig population has died as a result of an epidemic disease. And the Chinese have also discovered that other countries simply are not in a position at the moment to fill Chinese demand for soybeans to the extent that the US can. I mean, the Russians have made it very clear that at the moment they simply do not have the capacity to come anywhere close to matching American soybean production and exports. So from both sides, both countries have an incentive at the moment to work towards a temporary deal. And I think it is going to be a temporary deal, because as is often said, all things are related. Whilst there's been an easing off in the trade conflict, other parts of the US-China relationship are continuing to be extremely tense. The US is still campaigning in Europe for European countries to have, you know, to avoid getting into state deals with Huawei. This is still a big issue for the US. And of course, the US is also becoming increasingly alarmed at the sheer scale of the Chinese naval buildup in the Pacific, which is on a scale which has perhaps not been seen since the Second World War, and which is taking the US increasingly by surprise and is causing great alarm there. So there were pragmatic reasons why both sides backed off. There are ultimately, it seems to me, pressures that will mean that once this ceasefire has been worked through, we will continue to see this divorce, this economic divorce, take place.
Okay, so in what way are we going to see this divorce continue? So, because we've got a success here in phase one, or what looks like to be a success in a way, a ceasefire.
A ceasefire, yeah.
Which has been,
which has been attempted before. They've never quite managed it. They seem to be heading towards the ceasefire, and then invariably and always, new arguments would come in and they'd all, you know, the whole thing would resume and escalate again. But I think this time it's for real. I should make that very clear.
And it seems that this time it's for real, though, because at least listening to you and reading articles on this, the Trump White House, the Trump administration does seem to have pulled out a small victory here because this was possible because of the pressure via various reasons that the Chinese government was feeling due to various tariffs that they had in place. For example, what you said about pork is one, or soybeans. So, I mean, it does seem that strategically the Trump White House pulled out a small little victory here.
A very small one, because I don't think it's going to make a great deal of
difference. In these types of negotiations, though,
Trump can use it
on the domestic campaign trail.
This is the key point for him. This is at the moment, I mean, to be very clear about this, this is his overriding priority. We have to understand that in 2020, for Donald Trump, as for any US president who found himself in the same situation, the priority now is to get reelected. So he's got to convince the people back home in the United States that he's a tough and successful negotiator, that he's winning ground with the Chinese, and at the same time, he's protecting agricultural jobs in the Midwest. And I think this deal enables him to do that. So as a political gain, unquestionably, in the longer term, what I think is going to happen is that both the US and China understand that this period of time that used to exist, the so-called Chimerica, as people in Europe used to say, where the US and Chinese economies seem to be joined at the hip, is over. The Chinese are turning inwards. They are turning towards developing their economy on the basis of their own domestic markets, that the Chinese are going to, instead of selling cheap exports or indeed exports to the US, which is their primary market, they're going to be focusing increasingly on developing their own domestic market. And instead of importing vast amounts of raw materials from all over the world, I think they're going to concentrate increasingly on getting those raw materials from Eurasia, from their own Eurasian backyard, which means first and foremost from Russia. So we're going to see China retreating towards a more closed economy. And I think the same thing is going to increasingly happen with the US. I think that the US has realized that overdependence on trade with China is politically and geopolitically dangerous because China is a potential superpower rival. So I think that the US is saying to itself, obviously we still want to import goods from all kinds of people, but we will go for countries like Vietnam and Mexico and Indonesia and wherever, not China, which is a country which can potentially threaten us.
All right. So what's the next step here? I mean, are we waiting till after the 2020 election for any more negotiations to take place? Has this been put on hold now till after 2020?
Yes. I think, first of all, there will be more negotiations over the course of 2020. But I think the major decision has now been made. And we will see a ramping down of sanctions. And then before very long, we will be in the campaigning period. And that makes it essentially impossible for any substantive negotiations to take place. What I think is going to happen henceforth is that negotiations will be an almost continuous thing. We will not see ever, I think, a final, conclusive, all-encompassing deal between China and the United States. They will always come back and they will negotiate with each other, and it'll be, sometimes it'll be one thing, sometimes it will be something else, but these negotiations will go rolling on after 2020, whichever president, by the way, is elected, until eventually, as I said, the kind of divorce that I was talking about comes. And as I said, that, it seems to me, is inevitable.
Right. So you have really two roads here. You have, on the one side, you're going to have rolling negotiations.
Yes.
Just continue onwards past 2020.
Yes.
And on the other path, you're going to have what is essentially an economic divorce between the two countries as they, line up against each other, one superpower against the other other superpower. Eventually, though, those roads are going to be incompatible, are they not? Well, indeed.
I mean, can I just say, I expect China and the US to continue to trade with each other in some form. But as I said, this incredible intimacy, Chimerica, is over. And I think it's over for good. And two rival superpowers, and it's the United States and its allies versus China and its allies in Eurasia. Two rival superpowers are not going to be joined at the economic hip. Eventually, these trade negotiations, all of this, is going to run its course. We will be left with two separate economic poles. There will continue to be some movement of people and trade between each other, but we will be fully back into a bipolar world such as existed during the Cold War. Won't be quite as rigid as it was then, but there will be two distinct economic, political, and financial alliances operating within their own spheres. And I think that is the world we're going to be looking at. And I think that will continue once it's achieved for many decades.
Is the Chinese economy going through some difficulties right now?
Yes. Well, of course, its growth rates. Its growth rates have unquestionably fallen. I mean, they're probably lower than the Chinese are saying. The Chinese say that they're about 6.5%. They're more probably around 5%. But a lot of this is the inevitable consequence of an economy that has matured and has perhaps somewhat overreached itself as an industrial manufacturing exporter. What the Chinese need to do, I mean, first of all, I should make, it's a point which I've explained many times, but people never seem to understand it. Growth in itself is not a good thing for an economy. Obviously, it is better for an economy over time to grow, but sometimes economies need to slow down so that they can rebalance. And I think that is what China is going to do. They need to sort out, they need to reduce this excessively high investment rate they still have in the productive sides of the economy, rebalance towards a culture of, greater services and consumer spending. And this will probably take some time. I mean, we could be looking at 5 to 10 years of a slower growing Chinese economy than the one we're used to. Ultimately, and in the long term, that is not a problem. I mean, economies do slow down some over periods, and they also speed up over periods. It is the nature of economies. Economies that try to grow continuously at fast rates all the time invariably end in a smash. That is an iron economic law. At least as an iron historical economic law. So yes, the Chinese economy has problems. It will adjust to them, provided, as I said, the Chinese themselves act sensibly. But I come to what I've said. It is already a huge economy. And it could, I think, make a natural matchup with the various Eurasian states, which are its hinterland behind it. What we will not see is China being this enormous, aggressive export machine that it was for 15-year period between roughly 1995 and 2010.
All right. And finally, Alexander, the U.S. economy, it's out of tear. How do you see
things? Well, the only thing I would say about that, it's on a tear, except investment rates are falling and productivity is flat. When you look at it, when you actually unpack the numbers, a lot of this expansion is, well, in fact, most of this expansion seems to be driven by much higher government spending. I was reading somewhere in one of the somewhere in the financial press that in the middle of an economic recovery, the Trump administration and Congress and, you know, the Democratic House of Representatives are reflating more the economy more than happened under Barack Obama after the 2008 crisis. I mean, it is a huge rush in spending, and that has accelerated the economy markedly. And it will, I am sure, carry through beyond the 2020 election. So, and on the tails of it, I expect, you know, Trump, I personally expect Trump to be reelected. After that, after 2020, the US needs to rebalance also. And that logically means accepting a significant slowdown and perhaps even at some point a recession. You know, we shouldn't be afraid of recessions. Recessions are part of the normal life of every great economy. And the mistake is, as I said, to try to keep the foot on the accelerator on all the time, irrespective of, you know, underlying fundamentals. I think, as I said, there are plenty of people in the US who are looking at this, and they do see that there are problems starting to emerge. As the investment rates are low, productivity is not rising as it should. And at this point in the cycle, in an economic cycle, it's perhaps time to start thinking after 2020 towards rebalancing the economy also. But, you know, if there's a slowdown in the US, if the US economy has a recession, if it slows down a couple of percentage points, it's not the end of the world. It does not mean the end of the US. These sort of things we need to, you know, maintain a sense of proportion about.
All right, Alexander Mercurius, Editor-in-Chief of the Duran, thank you very much. Guys, if you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on that notifications bell to make sure you get notifications when we publish a new video. Check us out on iTunes and on SoundCloud for an audio copy of this video as well. And please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar. Your donation really means a lot to us. And look for this video on duranvideo.com and on bitchute.com. We post all our videos on those two platforms. And download the Telegram app and follow us there, where you will be kept up to date on everything going on in the Duran community, including the DRN20 discount at the Duran shop, 20% off all merchandise, and the launching of two new ebooks with an intro. Both of those ebooks have an intro via Alexander Mercurius. And those books focus on Ukraine Gate, the Ukraine Gate hoax, and a great ebook on the Epstein story.
Yes, I mean, these are two huge stories, both centering and starting in the US, but both obviously with international ramifications, because they both involve all kinds of people who are non-Americans. I mean, Ukraine Gate involves lots of Ukrainians, as we know. And of course, Epstein is now becoming a scandal, a serious scandal in Britain, where the royal family, through Prince Andrew, is now directly affected. Now, these are the two big stories, I think, in the US at the moment. The impeachment, which is one of the most, I think, preposterous political scandals I have ever come across. I mean, it's this extraordinary imbalance in America between this country that has so many strengths and a political system that has now become so disastrously dysfunctional. But what we set out to do in this book is show how absurd and misconceived and ultimately empty the Ukrainegate story is. I mean, if Russiagate was a massive tragedy, Ukraine is just, Ukrainegate is just a low farce, an ugly low farce. And that's what our book does. We bring together all our discussions on this topic, and I write a preface, as Alex says, in which I try to tie it all together and show the kind of absurd thing and grossly partisan thing that Ukrainegate ultimately is. Now, Epstein is even more extraordinary in some ways, because this is a real scandal. I mean, this is a very mysterious, very creepy individual. We still don't really know very much about Epstein. In fact, it's extraordinary how little we still know about Epstein. So all these guesses and speculations and rumors about who he was and what he was doing and how he made his money. All we know, what we do know for a fact, is that he was a monster. He was a serial trafficker, abuser of children, probably a rapist as well. I'm fairly sure of it, given the kind of things that he was involved in. I mean, he was a monster on a massive scale. And there's two things to take away from this. Firstly, that his enormous wealth and power and privilege and his position within US and international society and this extraordinary collection of friends he had, people like Bill Clinton, Prince Andrew, they gave him protection to do all the things that he did in clear view. I mean, there was no real attempt to conceal what he was doing. And now, even after his mysterious and unexplained death, that is still the case, because this scandal is not being reported to anything like the extent that it should be reported. So there is still this extraordinary silence that we have to try and battle against to break through in order to discuss this scandal. We at the Durand have encountered it. We've had a lot of trouble with social media providers trying to get the story about Epstein out. We've had all kinds of issues with it. So these are the two stories that we, the two big topical issues that we've done ebooks on. And I think people who are interested in these stories and finding out the truth about them will find those two ebooks indispensable to understand these two affairs properly. But of course, we don't just do ebooks on our shop. We do lots of other things. We have our fantastic Durand mugs, which we've shown off so many times. Amazing mugs like this, 15 ounces, beautiful porcelain body, double-headed eagle of the Russian Federation there, like you find on Vladimir Putin's mugs. It keeps your tea and coffee and hot chocolate hot, and it keeps your beer and champagne cold. I can confirm that, because I've tried it with those. I've had a bottle of gin as a present from a Durand fan, Mr. Ian Puddick. I've not drunk my gin from this these mugs, because frankly I think cocktails should be drunk from clear glasses. But it turns out that Mr. Puddick, who follows us on the Durand, buys our mugs. So, you know, we of course have to have his gin, an amazing gin it is. It's it is provided to Buckingham Palace and to Lancaster House and to the British government and to all sorts of people there. And it is the best gin I've had, and I know an awful lot about gin. Gin is our English drink. So, Durand mugs, you might even, if you're lucky, find yourself in possession of a fine bottle of gin if you meet people who also follow the Durand in the same way. I met him, by the way, whilst I was Christmas shopping at Fortnum and Mason's, where he was selling his gin. Anyway, that's another story. So we don't just have mugs, we also have shirts, like the shirt I'm wearing now, 100% cotton, incredibly comfortable. It's got the Durand double-headed eagle there. I've also got my magnificent, wonderful, amazing polo shirts, which I'm taking with me on holiday to the Alps, where we're going skiing. Again, 100% cotton. I'm also taking my long sleeve t-shirts with me to the Alps because, you know, it can get pretty cold there, especially when you're walking your dogs. And those will keep me warm. And you've also got other amazing things on our shops. You've got stickers, you've got hats, you've got hoodies. You've got amazing things in our shop. This is still the good season to buy presents, both for yourself and for your friends and for your family. DRN20, as Alex said, is the discount code. It is still running and will continue to do so for some weeks yet, beyond the new year. So what are you waiting for? Help the Duran, help yourself, come along, buy these amazing things. Alex will tell you how.
Just go to theduranshop.com and put in the discount code DRN20. Alexander McCurry, Editor-in-Chief of the Duran, thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.